Hey guys, Mike back with you. One of the questions we're always asked is, hey, when is a review course going to come to my area? The best resource for you is to check flightbridgeed.com. Courses are being updated almost daily. If there's not one coming next to you, guess what? We've got the fully accredited online university where you can take courses from FlightBridgeEd, FoamFrat, and the list goes on. So check out FlightBridgeEd.com today for more information.
What is a lighthouse? It is a tower with a bright light at the top, located at an important or dangerous place. The main purpose of a lighthouse is to serve as a navigational aid and to warn of dangerous areas. Welcome to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast. Illuminating the darkness of current EMS clinical practice with the bright light of science. Here are your hosts, Dr. Jeff Jarvis and Mike Verkest.
Howdy, y'all. This is Dr. Jeff Jarvis. I hope y'all are keeping your head above water in this age of COVID craziness. Down here in Texas, the weather is absolutely gorgeous. It feels like life should be getting back to normal. Except our case counts continue to climb, and we just had our first outbreak at a nursing home. Now, I've historically kept all things long-term care well outside of my attention span. As a paramedic, I'd respond to nursing homes, and as a doctor, I'd take these patients from EMS, and I'd do the same thing that y'all probably do. I'd complain about the lack of acute care capacity, and I'd probably joke about everyone who knows the patient was probably out on break. In short, I made judgments about things I didn't know much about. In other words, I was kind of an asshole. Well, I've been tasked with a new public health role during this whole outbreak. And I've been voluntold to serve on a long-term care task force. This has mostly, for me anyway, meant following along in email threads between the folks who actually specialize in geriatrics and know something about what's really going on in these facilities. Now, this has been tremendously educational for me. Now, in one of those recent email threads, I saw a paper was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. It was about a prevalent study in a King County nursing home. Now, talking about nursing home papers is definitely a first for me, but I would like to run through this paper. I think it's a well-done description of COVID in nursing homes, and it has some good points to ponder as we navigate our way through this brave new world. Now, this isn't your typical research paper. It wasn't a randomized trial by any means. It was a descriptive study of the prevalence of SARS-CoV-2 in a single nursing home in King County, Washington. Now, the exact facility isn't named in the paper, but they do imply it wasn't that nursing home, you know, the one we've all heard about. This is a bit of a storytelling paper. They describe the timeline of what happened when someone came to work sick. Then they started widespread testing, and this paper tells us about what they saw. The name of the paper is Pre-Symptomatic SARS-CoV-2 Infections and Transmission in a Skilled Nursing Facility. It was written by an investigative team of what I suspect are epidemiologists. They were from Public Health Seattle and King County and the CDC, and the lead authors are Mrs. Ahrens and Hatfield. It was published online April 24th, 2020, and we are recording this podcast the next day on the 25th. So now for the story. So as a reminder, the first U.S. case of COVID was January 20th in Snohomish County, Washington. In late February, there was a nursing home in Kirkland, Washington. I think most of us have heard about that. That occurred in late February. And because of this, there was an increased awareness of the dangers of COVID in nursing homes. Well, at this facility, a staff member came to work with symptoms on February 26th and 28th. She worked on a single unit in that facility, and she tested positive March 1st. On March 2nd, a resident on that unit developed symptoms and was hospitalized. On March 5th, they tested positive. Now, from that point on, the unit instituted enhanced infection control procedures, and that meant visitors were severely restricted, communal activities were canceled, and all staff members wore full PPE. Now, interestingly, what they defined as full PPE was gown, gloves, eye protection, and surgical mask, and that's because they didn't have any N95s available. Now, they only wore this when they went into the room of residents who had symptoms. They didn't do it for asymptomatic people. So that was on March 5th. Then 3 days later on March 8th, an epi team from both public health and the CDC went on site and started their investigation. It initially focused just on that unit with a positive resident and staff member. They offered nasal pharyngeal PCR testing to all 15 residents on the unit. And just as a reminder, PCR testing, that is the test that looks for the presence of virus. That's not the antibody testing that nobody really knows what to do with. This is the viral testing. So they offered it to 15 residents on the unit, 13 accepted, 6 of them, or 46%, were positive, and of those who were positive, 33% of them were asymptomatic. Then on March 9th, the facility went to universal droplet precautions for every resident on that unit, regardless of symptoms. The next day, March 10th, every resident in the facility, not just the impacted unit, was offered testing. This initial round of tests was then repeated a week later. Along with testing, every resident also had a comprehensive symptom survey conducted covering any symptom that they had in the prior 14 days. So figure one in the paper really tells the story well, and I've copied it into the show notes. It's essentially a consort chart describing the results of the test. I'm not going to run through the whole thing, but take a look at the show notes. It really is informative. So let's just go through now what my bottom line takeaways are. 64% of the residents in this facility tested positive within just a bit over 3 weeks from the first positive case. That means this virus spreads like wildfire in a group living facility. Now, this is particularly dangerous in a SNF where you have elderly residents with a whole bunch of comorbidities. Now, if you compare that to other places with communal living, I would anticipate the mortality in those places to be a bit lower just because the people there are, generally speaking, healthier. But I would expect the same rate of spread in other places. And other places I'm talking about here are like jails and cruise ships and dorms and, I don't know, aircraft carriers. All right, so of the people who tested positive, 56% of them were asymptomatic on that initial screen. Now, of those asymptomatic patients, 89% of them became symptomatic within the next week. Of the staff, the full-time staff anyway, that was tested, 19% of them came back positive. Fortunately, none of them required hospitalization. Now, of the positive residents, 19% of them required hospitalization. Of all patients who tested positive, 26% of them died. So that's a relatively high mortality rate. But it's interesting because the mortality rate is higher than the hospitalization rate. Now, what that suggests to me is that there were many pretty sick patients who were not hospitalized. And that makes sense because given the presumed condition of many of these residents, old age, comorbidities, dementia perhaps, they probably had a fair number of DNRs, and there's probably a heavy emphasis on palliative care. Again, something I think for this population is probably appropriate. Well, why is that important? Well, from an EMS standpoint, we shouldn't necessarily assume that all symptomatic patients are going to need transport. Now, that is assuming this is an enlightened skilled nursing facility that isn't trying to just eject all patients who are positive off onto the emergency department. As we'll talk about in a bit, it may make sense to take positive patients out of that environment, but that doesn't mean that the emergency department is the appropriate place for them. So there may be some other facilities that are designated specifically for COVID positive patients. That would make sense. Now, this facility initially started out only requiring PPE around symptomatic patients. And I think that probably is similar to what most of us have done in our responses. But because of the rate of asymptomatic patients and the ability to spread the disease while asymptomatic, they rapidly determined this wasn't going to work, and they went to universal droplet precautions for everyone. Now, this is assuming they're probably not doing a whole lot of aerosolized procedures. So they also suggest that recovery from symptoms in positive patients is insufficient to determine when staff can clear them. Instead, they say you really need to use a test-based strategy. Now, that's similar with our EMS systems. When we have someone who is positive, we can do a symptom-based return to work, but it probably makes more sense to require two negative tests 24 hours apart and at least 7 days since the onset of symptoms. At least that's the approach the CDC uses. Now, finally, they point out the catch-22 that this virus puts us in. Although many residents without symptoms had the virus, many patients with symptoms did not have it. That means we can't just put all symptomatic patients into a single ward, and the reason is that a lot of the symptomatic patients aren't going to have it, and we just ended up putting them next to people who do have it. And that means we would end up with more positives. So my real bottom line conclusion is that this virus is pretty scary. The combination of its contagion combined with its asymptomatic spread makes it very hard to contain without widespread testing. Now, as I was reading this cheery little paper, I learned we had our very own nursing home outbreak. Now, we're still very, very early on, and I don't know all or even most of the details about it. So far, we do know that about 25% of the residents in the facility are positive, and almost all of them are asymptomatic. Now, if this paper is representative of what we should expect, most of these will likely develop symptoms. Well, I'd now like to bring in my friend and colleague and fellow podcaster, Dr. Jason Pickett. Dr. Pickett is the Deputy Medical Director for Austin Travis County EMS, just to my south. He also got pulled into the public health response to COVID, and he's been dealing with 4 nursing home outbreaks in his county. I'd like to chat with him about his thoughts on this paper, his experiences, and the lessons that he's learned so far. Well, welcome to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast, Jason. So thanks for joining us and sharing your thoughts on this paper and on the interaction between COVID and nursing homes. Why don't you give us an idea about what you've been up to lately? It sounds like you've kind of wandered off of the strictly EMS reservation there.
Well, that's true, Jeff. And when this thing started, I was in the public role, the public health role as alternate health authority, and starting to look at how we were standing up the response within Austin Public Health. But then we saw this bridge into EMS, and a lot of the initial actions that we took within EMS were to be able to direct people to appropriate resources for testing. That didn't mean, hey, take me to the ER, because that's not really an appropriate resource for testing, but also to help find ways that we could protect our employees and our first responders so that they didn't have to be exposed in the first place if somebody had symptoms and didn't need to be transported. And so that grew into our clinical consult line. And then this response just expanded as we find more and more populations that are affected by this virus. And so now I'm in an incident command role, kind of cross-leveled as my own medical branch director, to help to manage all of these different task forces and strike teams and groups that we have to address specific areas of this virus.
Well, let's back up a little bit. Where were you, say, this time last year? What was your role? What was Mark's role? And then how has that changed a little bit, at least from an EMS standpoint?
So last year, neither one of us was actually in public health. And so a few months ago, we got sworn in as the public health authority and alternate public health authority. And then in a few months later, we get a pandemic. So it was really very poor timing on our part, apparently. A year ago, we were both full-time EMS docs.
Is Dr. Escott doing anything EMS right now?
At this moment, his time is taken up almost entirely by public health and COVID. And so I'm doing a lot of the EMS stuff, but also cross-covering him on public health. And our associate medical directors, Dr. Ackrell, Dr. Schreffler, Dr. Abraham, they've really stepped up in helping with the EMS side.
Well, man, y'all are really lucky because you got some great associates there. Those are all really impressive docs and they're great people.
There are some awesome people I get to work with. I'm cool by association with all these folks, and not just the physicians, with Travis Baker, our PA, and Bill Leggio, and Luis Gonzalez, Jeff Hayes, and Devon Banning, and Kimberly Batesman. All these folks who have really come together. Bill Cole, oh my gosh. So our infection control guy, who we hear from with things when we transport somebody with meningitis, or there's an infection control consideration for a new device or procedure or anything like that. But in this, then he has really just like put on his cape and waded out into it. So when our crews are, when they are exposed to somebody and he's helping to do the contact tracing and figures out if there's somebody in the hospital that had COVID, he goes back, figures out who it was that transported them to let them know and make determinations on exposure and all that. And it's just been awesome. Within public health, we building out these epidemiology teams and contact tracing, and really as that scope gets larger and larger, that team has been crushing it, even though there's not nearly enough of us. And public health funding in the United States in general, and in Texas in particular, is really extremely poor. And we're 40-somethingth in the country for public health funding here in Texas.
I'm kind of hoping that's one of the good things that we learn from this. You know, the one lesson, number one lesson I've learned is stockpile PPE that comes in a non-disposable version. And number two is perhaps we shouldn't shortchange public health.
Those are number one and two, maybe number two and one. The backend work on some of this stuff is unbelievable. Early on in this, when we had our first case here in Austin, that one person generated 400 close contacts that needed to be traced. With the shelter in place, that has helped it. That's made it easier for us because the clusters that we see, the contacts that we see are in smaller family groups. And so that makes that process a bit easier. As we open up, that's going to get a lot harder. And there's a much greater need for these epi teams to do that contact tracing.
My graduate degree is from a public health school, so I had to take epidemiology and all the normal stuff. But we didn't really focus on what true epidemiology, boots on the ground, what they do day in and day out. Picture CSI, but instead of murders, look at illness. And they're doing a lot of hard work.
That's a good metaphor.
it's amazing stuff. It's the modern day version of Jon Snow. not Game of Thrones, Jon Snow.
Yeah, you know nothing, Jon Snow.
Exactly.
On the other side of things, where I'm more embedded now, this has become the doctorate level incident command system. I've been part of big incidents before, but nothing on this level, nothing to this duration before. And I don't think really any of us have. People of Austin have been amazing at doing social distancing and far beyond our even most optimistic expectations of that. And that's given us time, but it's also given us time to identify there's always another group that is that is unfairly impacted by these sorts of things. These folks that just live by a thread under normal conditions, and now they're facing a true emergency that threatens these populations disproportionately, unfortunately.
Yeah, you're right. As with any tragedy, it does sort of expose the underbelly of American society. But let's take a look at one example of that. Let's take a look at the staff in nursing homes. I think most of us recognize that the folks who work in these nursing homes are not all that well paid. So this paper that we're looking at here, this whole thing started off when one of the staff showed up and worked her two shifts, but they were sick. So you think, why in the hell would you come to work with a bunch of old, vulnerable people when you're sick? So what's your take on that?
Nursing homes have been in a staffing crisis for years. This is nothing new right now. These staff members, they work two and three jobs. They're not paid very well for what they do and are woefully understaffed wherever they are. And certainly as EMS providers, we've seen that. I think that they're much like anybody else. I mean, I don't know about you, but I've come to work sick and I've worked an ER shift with an IV in place.
Yeah.
So I see where there is that dedication to duty and dedication to these nursing home patients who really don't have that many people to help take care of them to begin with, but also from that perspective of having to make ends meet. And I think that what we see now too is everybody is frightened by this. Everybody's frightened by COVID, and medical providers are no different. And especially in the nursing homes where COVID has a horrific toll among those patients. And for the staff members, they're frightened to get it, but they're also frightened for their patients whom they care very much about. And they know too, if they don't show up to work, who's going to take care of these folks?
Yeah.
You have to be a very special person to work in that environment, to get paid what they do, to have the workload that they do.
In my role as a paramedic, as an emergency physician, as an EMS doc, you know, I shared the same opinions that I think most people do about nursing homes. And that's the things that, you know, we develop these opinions based on going into a cardiac arrest or an acutely decompensated patient. But that's not the majority of what goes on in those nursing homes. And through this crisis, I've developed a whole new understanding for what they do, and certainly an appreciation. So one of the things that y'all did, we did the same thing. We issued some public health orders. Can you tell us a little bit about what those orders were that dealt with nursing homes?
So the couple of big ones that we've had are relative to nursing homes that have outbreaks of COVID cannot take on new patients until that outbreak has been solved. We also issued a public health order to order testing on the entire staff and patient population at one of the nursing homes where we have an outbreak, to help to inform our response and inform how we can help protect these patients more. What I can tell you is that our experience it very much aligns with what this paper shows that we're talking about.
Yeah.
That a high rate of asymptomatic spread, high rate of spread in general within the walls. That's given us some pause from what we originally thought we would do with nursing homes and with testing folks and so forth. And that has had us re-examining some of that.
You mentioned earlier a nursing home or a long-term care task force. I believe you were the one who volunteered me to get on that committee,
yep.
Which was interesting. It's been very educational for me. But one of the first things that task force started looking at was this concept of a COVID-positive nursing home. So tell me what the hell that is, and why would anybody want one of those things?
You definitely want one of those things in your community. So the initial idea that we had would be a nursing home that was was siloed off from other nursing homes, other nursing home populations. So you could send patients there who had COVID and that we could isolate them there, or they were treated in the hospital for COVID and you don't want to send them back to their nursing home that doesn't have COVID and then they introduce it to that population. So by creating a silo for those folks to be in, where they can be taken care of and they have their baseline level of medical care that they normally get, but we're not cross-populating or cross-pollinating and spreading by the staff going from those COVID patients to non-COVID patient wings and that sort of thing. Initially, our idea was that we would we'd identify somebody in a nursing home that had COVID, and we'd yank them out immediately and put them in this nursing home isolation facility. What we have found by experience is once you have discovered it in among the patients in the nursing home, then it's already there and it is already spreading. And removing that one patient will have little to no effect on the spread within the walls of the nursing home. And our testing has borne that out as well, where we see quite a few patients and staff members that are showing signs of the virus and didn't have symptoms. And then they get symptomatic a bit later. With this example, we had one patient who tested positive and that patient was hospitalized, but that patient's roommate had no symptoms whatsoever, tested that person. They were negative, like, okay, fantastic. And then what do you do with them? Because they are definitely exposed to it. And sure enough, within a few days, they did start showing symptoms and retested, and they were positive for it. So unfortunately, the early testing of those exposures doesn't help us to rule that out in those other patients. And my concern too is that you test that person, they're negative. Okay, great. We can put them in the non-COVID wing. Well, wait a few days and right. Then that's going to be a COVID wing.
Well, that is one of the things about this paper that they did. And, it's not like an RCT or anything, but it was an interesting description of what they did. And part of what they did was, number one, widespread testing. But number two, they recognized that that's just a shot in time, just like you were talking about. So they repeated it. And that actually gets us to a question that Dr. Zaid asked on Twitter. I put out a call for questions, and he said, "Well, hey, what do you think? Does this article support widespread testing of nursing home patients? And if so, do you think that the need for that is sufficient enough to say prioritize this population over other populations? What do you think about that?"
I think you're exactly right. It's a snapshot in time, and it's a lot like a pregnancy test. It's valid until the next time that you have intercourse, and then you need another test. So a COVID test is valid until the next time you happen to come into contact with somebody who has COVID, and potentially somebody who's asymptomatic who has it, and you don't know that you're exposed. Now, ideally, with rapid point of care testing for the virus, I'm not talking about the antibody testing. Those really have not borne out.
That nobody knows what the hell to do with.
A rapid viral test, isothermic tests, PCRs, and that. If we can do that to where we do surveillance on employees before they come into the nursing home that might be positive, might not be aware of it yet, then that might be helpful. The problem is that you can test somebody, but that still doesn't obviate the need for really having very strict infection control procedures within the nursing home. And I think that we are in that day and age now, having seen what this virus does to these nursing homes, is that we just need to be using universal PPE all the time and good infection control. That comes back to the earlier problem, is in order to have good infection control, you have to have enough staff. And no nursing home has enough staff. You have to be able to limit their travel. You don't have the same person bouncing all over multiple wings in the same nursing home, or congregating in the break room with other employees from other wings. That's how it really manages to move through those nursing homes so quickly. The testing has kind of hurt us in that it's good in that it shows us that people might be asymptomatic and potentially getting ready to spread, but that's it's not valid for very long, unless it's like the movie Gattaca, where you can just like sign in little prick of blood on your finger and then says you're good to go. I think that's where we need to be before that becomes truly that useful. Now, we've talked about doing surveillance testing on a regular basis for a nursing home staff and doing that like every week or something like that. Is that going to keep it out of the nursing home? Probably not. Couple asymptomatic day window happens to be in between tests, but that may be a way that we can start getting more folks to work there, and also with visitors, to bring some humanity back to the nursing homes and get their families visiting them again. If there's some good way that we have to rapidly test them, to admit them to the facility, or to get them into the facility.
Let's talk a little bit about numbers here. The paper that we just reviewed showed overall in this nursing home, 64% of the residents were positive, and over half of those were asymptomatic, but it was really more that they were pre-symptomatic, because 89% of the asymptomatic positives became symptomatic within a week, and they were pretty sick. I mean, a 26% mortality. In the nursing home outbreaks that you've seen, are they tracking with what we're seeing in this paper?
We are tracking quite a bit of asymptomatic staff members as well as patients in there, and we've seen the same thing where they're positive and then they get symptoms not too long thereafter. there's also a problem with knowing how useful that PCR test is, because you can shed that viral RNA for weeks after your infection and you've defervesced and you're not infectious anymore. And there's some evidence that really after about 8 days of symptoms, unless you're getting worse, then you're not going to be shedding infectious particles anymore, even though the viral RNA is still detectable.
Yeah, the whole testing issue is a challenge. You know, we talk a lot about sensitivity and specificity, and it's a bit of a moot point, because to calculate sensitivity and specificity, you need a gold standard. And all of our gold standards kind of sort of suck right now. Well, I'll tell you what, let's do this. Let's wrap up a little bit. And what I would like to close with is ask you for your opinion. What do you think the key things that nursing homes, public health, EMS, what should we be doing to deal with potential outbreaks of COVID in our nursing homes?
Well, I think first step is implementation of PPE, universal PPE within nursing homes. And we did that very early on with EMS here in Austin, that we required them, if you are setting foot into a nursing home for any reason, then you are wearing full PPE. And that's not to just to protect the employees, but that's also to protect the patients from the employees. And in order to do that, you have to have the right amount of PPE. And for the nursing home staff to do that, you have to have the right amount of staff. So that's the second part, is you have to have enough people to implement these infection control procedures. We've now gotten nursing home strike teams so that we can supplement staff within those nursing facilities. Eventually, we're going to get a vaccine someday. It's going to be a while.
I hope.
I'm hearing it's still a year to a year and a half off before we actually see a usable vaccine.
Yeah, and you're being optimistic. You know, we don't have a vaccine for other coronaviruses, and those suckers aren't exactly new.
Those who are predicting a year to a year and a half, I think, are extremely optimistic.
Yep.
And I hope that bears out, that they can create one that's effective and safe in that period of time.
They might be able to get one. You know, Bill Gates probably has one, but that's only effective against the type of COVID that's spread by 5G.
since he's the one that invented this whole virus.
Obviously.
I'm just kidding. Please, Bill Gates lawyers, do not call me. I'm only joking.
That's right. We love you, Bill, even if I am a Mac guy. Well, I'll tell you what, you know, I mentioned that we had some questions out on social media, so let's see if we can hit some of those. Let's see. Jeffrey Evan asked, what do you think the new normal for EMS is going to be once COVID is sort of knocked down, whenever the hell this world is? What is our PPE going to be? What's it going to look like when we go into nursing homes?
I think that that going forward, this has been a big lesson learned as far as the utility of PPE and the importance of it. I think that in EMS, HIV did that a lot for us. Like, we didn't used to wear gloves or be quite so thoughtful about glove wearing. And then HIV came around and kind of scared everybody. Oh, crap, I need to be serious about this. And I think that we're seeing that now with COVID as well. And so I think that moving forward, even though it seems really strange for us right now to wear a mask on all calls, I don't think that will be so strange in the future, especially when you're dealing with these vulnerable populations.
Yeah, it's a good point. Well, Daniel Sturdivant, a medic who works with me, asked if we should include pulse ox screening for all healthcare providers. So right now we're doing temperature checks and symptom checks. Should we also be doing pulse ox checks? And the reason he's asking this, he's been reading about these silent hypoxic or happy hypoxic patients and wonders if maybe we are seeing some patients or some providers who are hypoxic, but they don't really know it. They're asymptomatic, and therefore they fall into this atypical presentation. So in other words, if we add in pulse ox to our screening, do you think we might be a little more sensitive?
I wonder about that myself. And with these happy hypoxics, they typically have other symptoms going along with it. Now, I read the EM Docs Facebook group, and everybody has an anecdote of, oh, I had this person who had toe pain, and it turns out that it was COVID-19. And like, oh, you know, what am I going
to
do? What can you do with that? You can't fight the power of anecdote.
Exactly.
But how useful is that for widespread screening procedures? I'm not so sure. It depends on what our pretest probability is with that too.
Good question. So Dr. Troutman, he asks, do you think there's any role for EMS to refuse to transport patients who are essentially medically stable out of a nursing home just because they're COVID positive?
I don't think so. And here's my thought. I think that like what we've done with the COVID clinical consult line with EMS and directing people to appropriate testing resources and primary care to try to keep them out of the hospitals and keep them out of the ambulances. We're typically not doing that on folks who are elderly with multiple comorbidities. And the nursing home patient, the mortality rate for COVID is pretty bad, but it's not 100%. And there's a lot of them we do expect to survive. And I think that saying, well, you've got a cough, you've got a fever, you're in a nursing home that has a COVID outbreak, we're not going to take you to the hospital. I don't think we're doing anybody any favors with that. This is a population that I would be more aggressive about transporting because we know that from COVID, their outcomes are often bad, but also because there's so many other things that can be going wrong that we can very effectively treat.
Yeah, great point. Do you think that there is any role for 911 calls where you show up on scene and let's say it's a otherwise healthy adult who has no psychosocial issues, seems like they should be able to take care of themselves. They went through one of these drive-through testing clinics and they ended up testing positive, and now they think because of that, they want to go to the hospital. And let's just say they have a cough and a fever, but their vital signs are okay. They have a little tachycardia, but it's commensurate with their fever, and their pulse ox is 96. Do you think there is a role for refusing to transport that patient with, of course, let's say, with adequate medical oversight and online consultation?
I really do. And I think that this is something that what we've been doing in Austin with our clinical consult line, so many patients call 911 because they want access to resources. They don't necessarily think that they need a hospitalization, but they want to know more. They need some education. They need to be hooked up with the right resources. We get a lot of calls for folks that like, I've got some symptoms. I don't think I need to go to the hospital. I just need to get a test. And then we can say, oh, you know what? Let's not send an ambulance there or a fire truck. Let me put you in touch with public health and we'll get you lined up for testing. And I think that this outbreak has given us the opportunity to test a lot of those systems, to roll those out. And we're doing it to protect the healthcare system as well. But this also gives us a way to study how can we do this thoughtfully and make better use of our healthcare resources. And so this I think between ET3 and this, then we're going to see a different face of EMS in the future where it's not necessarily you call, we haul. Now, unfortunately, all of the literature up until now on paramedic initiated refusal has showed some really bad outcomes.
Yeah.
And we still need to dial that in a little bit better. But I think dialing that in has a lot to do with helping people navigate that system a little better.
So we've been doing this also. We started using Pulsera. We're using it for what we started off thinking it was going to be about load balancing with the hospitals, but we, like our hospitals, have seen a decrease in our volume. What we end up using it for is teleconsultation. So they'll bring me in. We FaceTime with the patient. I had an elderly woman with what she initially described as chest pain and shortness of breath. Crew got there and said, you know, I'm not so sure about this. They talked to me. I did a history with them. And it turns out what she was actually feeling is palpitations because she was having PACs. Hmm. So, you know, I was able to see the EKG. I could talk to her. She was actually the one who brought it up. Hey, I don't want to go to the hospital. I hear they have COVID cooties there. Well, ma'am, you're right. You probably don't need to go to the hospital. Let's just get you set up with your doctor and have you follow up with them. And she loved it. I've had other patients I've adjusted. I can't believe I'm saying this as an EMS and ER doc, but I'm adjusting their blood pressure meds and keeping them out of the hospital, and they seem to like it. Now we just need to find a way to get paid for doing that.
Yeah, and I think that the opening up of telemedicine for establishing that physician-patient relationship and being able to bill for that, I think that helps a lot. Now, hey, maybe you call, we haul, that's all, isn't the best way to do it. We don't have to just make that non-transport happen out of the goodness of our hearts. But yeah, we can create a system that puts people in touch with the right care providers, with the right resources, and doesn't include just driving them in a fully critical care equipped ambulance to a hospital emergency department and all of the expense and everything that comes with that. We can thoughtfully navigate people to where they need to be.
Absolutely. So there may be many things that come from this. Certainly with the rise and fall of Zoom, the rise of Teams, of teleconferencing. I was talking with someone who works at a tech company, and when this happened, they went exclusively to work from home and found out they were way, way more productive. So I think that we are going to see a lot of things change. So probably a whole lot more people telecommuting. I think we'll see, we just wear masks as normal PPE, as you pointed out earlier. And we're probably going to end up doing a whole lot more telemedicine. I was on a conference call with my hospital, and we're a multi-specialty group, so we also staff primary care clinics. And one of the things that we had been trying to figure out how to do for a long time is transition over to more telemedicine. Well, baby, this did it. And that's probably not going to change. It just has to be, the payers have to make it financially sustainable, because God knows the patients love it.
True. And you look into a lot of these institutionalized settings, not just the nursing homes, but into jails and homeless shelters and group homes. And that's where this could be a really great way to help them to navigate this system. And so that's, I think, some of the good that is coming out of this terrible situation is that we are starting to really think creatively, and it's allowing us the opportunity to smash that model. Now we're motivated to say, how can we do this? Because we want to save our providers, and we want to prevent spread to other patients, and we want to limit exposure. And I think that there are a lot of good things from that end that will come out of this.
Because I'm old enough to have watched this when I was a kid, I'm reminded of Steve Austin, the $6 million man, and the intro to it. You know, astronaut has a crash, and they said, we can rebuild him. We can make him stronger, faster. This COVID epidemic is showing the strains on our healthcare system. Maybe we can make it bigger, better, faster, and work better for other people. So one of the additional things that's come from this, we have seen some things on social media. Different systems are changing the way they work cardiac arrest. They're not working them. And if they're unwitnessed asystole, we're seeing a lot of discussions in other aspects of healthcare about really pushing people toward palliative care. What are your thoughts on that?
So I think that this has become very important within our nursing home population, and our geriatricians here in Austin have restarted those discussions with family members, a detailed discussion about do not resuscitate orders and do not hospitalize orders, and helping to set some expectations for their patients. And that is something I think that we as physicians, we mentioned that, like, okay, if you had to have CPR, would you want everything done? But then really sitting down and laying out what happens when you have a cardiac arrest, or if you are an elderly patient with multiple comorbidities and you're already requiring a substantial amount of medical support, and then you add an acute disease on top of that, do you really want us to make a full court press? And so they're restarting those conversations with family members so that from the outset, we can be a bit more thoughtful in how we take care of folks. And for those that really are not in a position where they're going to be discharged from that nursing home to where their quality of life may not be terrific because of these medical conditions, then this is a good time to have that discussion and to set the family's expectations. So when that call comes in the middle of the night that your mother is very ill or something like that, then it's not the knee-jerk, oh my gosh, we've got to put her in the ICU and do all of these things. Now, I think that some of that discussion has gone to EMS, and we have talked about the futility of some of the resuscitations that we attempt on people. And I agree with that. I think there are some folks that are taking it a little too far, saying we shouldn't be doing any cardiac arrests in the field at all.
Yeah.
Like, well, wait a second. Like, there's a lot of people in Austin that survive neurologically intact that have great outcomes and get to shake their hand again.
And
all that. So let's not baby out with the bathwater.
Exactly.
But I think you're right. When you have the unwitnessed asystolic cardiac arrest, then what is their outcome look like? And does that mean that we should be going full court press on everybody, or should we be more thoughtful about it?
Yeah, I'll tell you, my take on that is, I think because there are some neurologically intact survivors, I don't think I'm ready to say don't ever begin resuscitation on an unwitnessed asystolic arrest. But I do think it's reasonable to initiate the resuscitation, and then with online consultation, perhaps we'll terminate the arrest a whole lot quicker than we would have otherwise.
I agree with you. And I saw the articles come out about New York, and they're saying, well, now we're not transporting every cardiac arrest. We're terminating them in the field if they're not coming around. I'm like, we've been doing that for years.
Exactly.
Like, where you guys been?
That was a very frustrating Twitter moment there. One of many frustrating Twitter moments. Well, Dr. Pickett, thank you so much for joining the podcast. I really appreciate your insights, and I think it adds a lot to this discussion. Thank you so much.
Dr. Jarvis, thank you so much for having me on the EMS Lighthouse, and I look forward to doing this more in the future.
You've been listening to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast, a proud member of the FlightBridge Ed podcast family and a Fire Dog production. Visit flightbridgeed.com for more information.